You're listening to Medscape's In Discussion series on psoriasis, a podcast where thought leaders and clinical experts share their diverse insights and practical ideas for optimizing patient care. This series is hosted by Dr. Stephen R. Feldman, editor of the Journal of Dermatological Treatment and professor of dermatology at the Wake Forest University School of Medicine in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Relevant disclosures can be found with the episode show notes on Medscape.com or the Medscape app. The topics and discussions are planned, produced, and reviewed independently of advertisers. This podcast is intended only for U.S. healthcare professionals.
Hi, I'm Dr. Steve Feldman. Welcome to Medscape's In Discussion series on psoriasis. This is episode 3, and we'll be discussing approaches to monitor systemic treatments used for psoriasis. Opinions and approaches on how to manage psoriasis and monitor systemic treatments can vary tremendously, and I'm very happy to welcome two outstanding psoriasis experts to discuss their approaches to drug monitoring for psoriasis. First, we have an international authority on complex medical dermatology, aesthetics, and skin cancer. Having done many of the clinical trials that led to approval of psoriasis treatments, she has extensive long-term experience managing patients treated with these psoriasis treatments, both new and old. She's a board-certified dermatologist and clinical researcher, recognized for her leadership in advancing psoriasis therapeutics and evidence-based monitoring standards. Practicing in Dallas as medical director of modern dermatology and directing multiple large clinical research programs that have shaped contemporary psoriasis care, we have Dr. Jennifer Cather. Our other guest today is a board-certified dermatologist who completed residencies in both family medicine and dermatology and is currently the director of the dermatology residency at the Larkin Health System and clinical assistant professor of dermatology at the FIU College of Medicine in Miami. He's a member of the board of directors of the American Academy of Dermatology and, like Dr. Cather, a member of the medical board of the National Psoriasis Foundation. That board guides the clinical direction and education for the organization. Our second guest serves on the editorial boards of the Journal of Clinical and Aesthetic Dermatology, the International Journal of Women's Dermatology, the Journal of Dermatological Treatment, and Practical Dermatology. Let's welcome Dr. Brad Glick. Brad, Jennifer, it's my pleasure to welcome you to In Discussion. Dr. Cather, when I first met you, I believe you were working alongside one of the giants of psoriasis care, Dr. Alan Mentor. I learned a lot about psoriasis from Alan, but I'm wondering if you have any memorable, perhaps even embarrassing stories about your time working with him.
He was very important in my life. So I want to set the stage, and I actually have two experiences. It won't take long. So remember, I'm old, okay? So I am working with Alan Mentor in 1998, 1999. That's when we started. And I'm fresh out of my residency. I trained down at MD Anderson with Madeline Duvick, major T-cell lymphoma, graft versus host vitiligo. I did not write one systemic for psoriasis. So Madeline tells me, if you're going back to Dallas, which is where my husband's family was, you got to work with Alan Mentor. I'm working with him, and I believe it's the first month, and I'm working up the patients. He comes in afterwards, and there's a little girl. She's in like first or second grade, covered with psoriasis. And I've already done the intake, is she up to date on immunizations, like the whole thing, right? He just goes in the room, blows me off, just blows right past me, blows past the parents, and shakes the little girl's hand and says, "I know what you have, and I'm going to make it better." And then he turns to the parents and he goes, "We're starting on cyclosporin." There's no conversation. The parents are like, "Just fix her." And I'm sitting there, I'm calling Madeline at the end of the day going, "He just put a kid on cyclosporin." And I mean, I was like all freaked out. And Madeline's like, "He knows what he's doing." And then the second humbling and embarrassing thing is that I think it was like the day after that, it seems like I was catastrophically decimated by this man who was treating appropriately, by the way, is the chart reviews that he made me do. And I'm coming across 5 suicide notes. And the suicide notes are in these charts. And by the way, for the people listening, we didn't have electronic medical records back in 1999. And it's talking about they can't take it anymore. They're running through and breaking too many dustbusters when they're sweeping up their scales. And I just sit there and I'm just going, "Oh my gosh, I have a dustbuster. That's really hard to do." In my residency, we didn't talk about invisible impacts of the disease and the psychosocial isolation. I'm really glad we're starting to do that now. So I was embarrassed because I thought it's just a rash. And then I was also kind of embarrassed that I didn't understand that people would commit suicide over a rash that they used to say didn't itch. That's what I read. And it was a benign arthropathy. That's what I read. And so I think we've come a long way. I'm really proud to be a dermatologist that's actually in the trenches trying to help these people, because it's a really underserved population.
We have come a long way. Brad, with all the leadership positions you've held and currently hold, I'm thinking you really must enjoy being in meetings, although I wonder if all that gray hair in the beard puts the lie to that. I tend to shun meetings, and I'm just wondering if any of the meetings that you've attended have been useful in any way.
You know, I think meetings are helpful. I think probably in the beginning part of your career, Stephen, I used to see you at a lot of meetings, and they do get to be very much the same, a lot of the same information. But I'll tell you one of the reasons why I go, because I still garner some pearls. And one of them, I remember vividly in 2006, I was at the AOCD meeting, a fairly small meeting. Nevertheless, the speaker was Alan Menter. And one of the things I vividly remember him talking about was white adipose tissue. And I'm thinking to myself, why the heck is he talking about white adipose tissue and adiposity? But he taught me that it's chock full of inflammatory cytokines. And you see, that's why we have great people like him and Jen that have really kind of carried this torch that it's more than just a skin disease. And I learned from him that I needed to treat these patients aggressively and systemically. And so that's just one example. While going to a meeting, you might get one really good pearl. And finally, I'm a newbie at clinical trials, unlike Dr. Cather, who's been probably doing them for about 25 years, and I'm not dating you. I mean, I'm not dating you.
Too late. Too late.
I would say, though, at the meetings, we also establish relationships with our colleagues who do trials and also those in industry who really provide leads for us for the opportunities to engage in the possibility of doing trials that are of interest to those of us that are principal investigators.
Well, we're going to get into monitoring now, drug monitoring. And my first question is, how do we know what monitoring to do? Are we following guidelines? Is there an evidence basis for this? Jen, let me let you start.
So I think the first thing that happens is we do clinical trials. And, you know, they're scientists and they look at mechanisms of action. The problem I have is clinical trials, you're studying such a small sliver of what you actually can see. Like, so we think about clinical trials, they're usually healthy, they're a given age, they don't allow them to have certain comorbidities or certain concomitant medications. So you have a microscope on this very small sliver of this patient population. And then, you know, you're neglecting a lot of cancer survivors, a lot of people living with HIV, things that we see every day. And so I think it's a good starting point, but I think that once you get used to how the drug's performing, you need some updates. You know, you need to do a version two, like this is what we know. Let's be clear. Every day I walk into clinic, I'm like, I hope I'm not going to hurt anybody. But I will tell you, the risk of not treating and embracing our modern medicines is really important. And again, I think that later on, we'll talk about where we've been and where we're going. And man, I've been in the past and I don't want to go back there. I love our targeted therapies that we have, designer drugs for dermatology. I'm practicing with the 2025 drugs, not the 1960 drugs.
Yeah. Besides clinical trials, we've got maybe some registry data. Anything else, Brad, any kind of data that we use?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are fairly well-established clinical guidelines that were updated a number of years back, starting in 2019, jointly between the AAD and the NPF. But I have to tell you, they don't always translate into clinical practice. It's like Jen said, we have to treat the patients. And even though they're now doing interim guideline updates, it used to be that we were waiting 6 and 8 and sometimes longer years to receive such guidelines. And so I think we do, as Jen said, had to take the clinical practicality out of the clinical trials and translate them to what's best for the patients. And that, of course, from a somewhat medical legal perspective, you know, look at that there is information in the package insert and follow it, I'll say, quote, somewhat. The big issue is that we're in about a 20-year period where we had older biologic therapies. When we had our first one, where we were doing blood tests like every week, to then TNF inhibitors, where we did them maybe once or twice a year, and we'd repeat them every single year, and some of our colleagues every 3 months or 6 months, and it was craziness, to where we are now. And as I like to say to patients, you would think with these therapies that have a 70% chance of clearing your skin, they are so much more effective that they'd be more unsafe, and they're not, and so it's great. And so we really don't need to over-monitor our patients. I think we can start with the basics. And a lot of those basics really are maybe even beyond the scope of dermatology. If we have a qualified family physician, we make sure, or an internist or cardiologist, we make sure our patients engage with those individuals so that they're being screened. So when they're assessing really more the monitoring of their health, not so much their blood work. And I also agree with Jen that, you know, first of all, our patients in clinical trials, it's not so common that we see a whole host of laboratory abnormalities. But on the other hand, it's very streamlined and it's very artificial and there's a lot of exclusions. It's not those real world patients that we see in the trenches. And I think the biggest challenge in the lab monitoring, which there's a lot of random potential to glean information from those labs tests, it's more about looking at the patients, looking at their weight, looking at their blood pressure, their overall health. Do they smoke, et cetera?
I think I once heard a top psoriasis specialist say that whenever he gave anybody anything that affected the immune system, he got a panel of lab work, including complete blood count, complete metabolic panel, urinalysis, chest x-ray, ANA, CRP, hepatitis profile, and maybe an HIV test. And I think I left one of them out. I can't even remember. And it would repeat those at intervals. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. There's downsides to doing all these testing.
I'm tired. And you know, it's weird. I feel like part of it is that you can, right? So we could, but why would you, right? I mean, unless you're like Brad, like I'm really impressed, a family practice person and a derm. So if you're going to do something because you got those lipids and you go ahead and you go order those lipids. I'm not ordering the lipids. I'm very lucky though. I'm in metropolitan Dallas. We've got really good doctors. So my sliver of people, they all have doctors. I'm their dermatologist, right? So if it's not a direct impact for me, I'm not checking it. And because whatever I get, I have to know what I'm going to do with. And I don't like just craziness.
You know, I think it'd be interesting to know if you monitor any drugs differently from what the package insert says, or if you've changed how you monitor things over time. But maybe we could think about those things in the context of specific drugs. And we'll start with the prototype for drug monitoring in psoriasis, methotrexate. Brad, how do you monitor? What blood tests are you doing in people on methotrexate?
Well, it's kind of an interesting question, because if you ask me even 5 or 8 years ago, I'd tell you a pretty straight up answer. I'd do CBC and the liver panel, and I might check it again a month later, and then every 3 months thereafter, and maybe, you know, twice a year. Lord knows I've learned from my rheumatology partners, they almost never check lab work. They maybe do it one time and that's it. And gosh, the word liver biopsy, maybe who even does those anymore after about 4 grams of methotrexate? We can talk about that. But the reality is I don't write too many prescriptions for methotrexate anymore because I really don't need it. I've been in practice 31 years. And yes, Jen, I'm old too. And you look way better than me. But the point is that it's so infrequent these days that I really don't worry so much about the monitoring. But it's kind of like the Dos Equis commercials. But when I do write for methotrexate, I do a baseline set of labs, including a CBC and probably chemistry, but focused on liver functions. And again, a month later, maybe 3 months later, and every 6 months thereafter. And, you know, it depends, though, because if someone's more of a drinker, or sometimes if someone's a little heavier and they might have metabolic-associated fatty liver disease, then that might be a little bit of a different story. But the challenging part of the question and the answer is that it's so infrequent, it's not a choice of mine. I will say, though, we have unique situations where rather than switching a drug, like today, I had someone on an IL-23 inhibitor. Their skin is really good. Their joints are breaking through. I mean, sometimes that's a nice opportunity to add a little bit of methotrexate, like we did with the TNF inhibitors. But I don't use them anymore As well. So that those are my basics. And you know, Jen maybe has a different answer.
Yeah. So I actually have some great experience with methotrexate, having three unplanned pregnancies in my clinic. So I think the big thing is that if I can avoid drama, I'm going to avoid drama. So I have maybe two or three people on it, and they're all on Remicade and just adding a little bit of methotrexate to Remicade. I think from a family planning, don't forget about the pregnancy stuff. But I'm like you, that's 1960s. Did it help? It was the only thing we had. I don't like the word anti-metabolite. I don't think we need to be using anti-metabolites for psoriasis, you know? So it's infrequent. It's infrequent for sure. And I can't remember the last time I ever put a woman on it.
And it's the folic acid. We have to, you know, add that in. And then everyone has slightly different protocols. The patients have to remember once a week. I've had them take all of their drugs in a 24-hour period, but then they forgot and they took it the next day. It's also that complexity too. And we don't have to really do that anymore.
Right. Agreed.
Super. Okay. Well, we've gone from the drug that requires maybe the most monitoring to what Zoom is going to be an easy one. What monitoring do you do for patients on apremilast?
Nothing.
Nothing. Oh, for the win. Yes.
Great. How about deucravacitinib?
I actually do, although I just share it freely here. You know, our exposure and education in dermatology for deucravacitinib has really obviously have recently kind of fallen off the map. It's only going to be utilized pretty much in the rheumatology space. But in answer to the question, it is in the Janus kinase family. And so we check some basic labs in the beginning. Some people do it a month later. I don't. It's on the health of the patient. And what I end up doing is I check some labs a couple of times a year. There appears to be perhaps some patients that get a little bit of low-grade hyperlipidemia. But I think that deucravacitinib, being an allosteric inhibitor of tyrosine kinase 2, is highly targeted. I really have not had particularly profound side effects, but I will tell you that I have picked up some liver function abnormalities about 6 months in a couple of patients. But I agree with you. I think that our use of this is going to become less until we get the new TYK2 inhibitors, mm-hmm. With a few ones coming in zascocitinib and also in vutacitinib. Yeah. So we will see. And I think it's going to be very much the same way. It is like a JAK inhibitor. And I think many of our colleagues have different opinions on the screening for Janus kinase inhibitors. But I think it's the basic stuff at baseline, CBC, maybe chemistries, you know, check the liver functions, fasting lipids, perhaps. Although I'm not sure that's necessary with that drug, and maybe a couple of times a year. And I think for me, not to get into a discussion about, let's say, atopic dermatitis and alopecia areata, at this point for the JAK inhibitors, I generally feel that they're pretty safe. Other than herpes zoster, which I've probably seen as my most common consequence of that therapeutic, which you really can't screen for other than making sure your patient's over 45 or so get the Shingrix vaccine, I'm just checking labs twice a year. And that's probably out of just habit. Yeah. And that's kind of what happened. Newer therapies for us years ago, like TNFs. Mm-hmm. And we had our colleagues doing blood, like we said earlier, twice a year, three times a year, four times a year, totally unnecessary.
Yeah. I don't monitor on it. And so I was going to be reckless in Dallas. You know, I think that a lot of it is medical legal, right? As an investigator, we only saw CPKs problems, you know? And then I just look at that pathway. I'm not really worried. So that's why I made him go first, because I think he can give you a much more reasonable answer, but I don't monitor.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. Just got a couple more to do. TNF inhibitors.
I do a QuantiFERON gold. And if they have a doctor and they're with a doctor, that's all I do. So now, to be clear, my one of the nurse practitioners in my practice does hepatitis panels for everybody and has found three cases of hepatitis. I think one was B and two were C in the last 3 years. There you go. Ask your questions.
Yeah, I would say 5 to 8 years ago, I did the annual hoopla, but I'm with Dr. Kavanaugh on this one, and that it's just a screening TB test. And in someone who's not in the high-risk population, preferentially, that's it. And follow them, particularly if they're followed by a general physician. And I think the only reason I tell patients this, particularly with the newer therapeutics, is that the only reason I'll do another one, a QuantiFERON gold, a year later is because the payer makes me do that. Otherwise, you're not going to get your medicine.
Yeah. So for the TNF inhibitors, I'm pretty similar. I'll get a baseline hepatitis panel, baseline TB test, and I'll repeat the TB test every year, in part because it's TNF inhibitors, in part because the insurers make me. Okay, and then IL-17 and 23 blockers. I'm going to lump those because I'm pretty sure we're going to monitor those similarly.
No labs.
I would say the same, except if you get that sheet of paper, then the payer asks you, what was the result of the quantiferon gold test or their TB test, I should say. So, you know, we didn't talk a lot about guidelines, but clearly, whether it's NPF, MPF, AAD guidelines really support the fact that you can do a screening quantiferon gold or not. It really doesn't need to be repeated ever again in healthy individuals or non-high-risk populations. And, you know, I'm sure you both know Anthony Fernandez's great data about repeating those quantiferon gold tests because they result in a whole host of false positives. And it's unnecessary. And he tallied up the cost, and the cost is ridiculous. It's in the multi-million.
Yeah. You know what's so funny is, like, look what the Europeans are different, right? Some of the clinical trial data, they actually had a positive, and it was their discretion, and they didn't do anything for chemoprophylaxis for TB, and nobody reactivated, you know? So I think that, again, we can do it, but should we be doing it? That's a different story.
The only other thing I would say is that I hear medical legal matters. That's the reason why we're doing some of that stuff.
All right. Well, I think we've covered the agents I wanted to cover that we currently have. There's one coming, hopefully, icotrokinra, oral interleukin 23. You think you're going to monitor that any differently?
No monitoring, Dr. Feldman, none. That's what we're going for. It's going to be exciting.
All right, everybody. Today we've talked to Dr. Jennifer Cather and Dr. Brad Glick on monitoring systemic psoriasis treatments. A couple things to take home. One, we have very limited data to know what monitoring has to be done, and you need to use good judgment. The older treatments needed some regular monitoring. The newer treatments need little to no monitoring. I hope you found this episode helpful. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Dr. Steve Feldman, and this is Psoriasis in Discussion.
Thanks for listening to Medscape's In Discussion Psoriasis podcast series with our host, Dr. Stephen R. Feldman. Be sure to look for more In Discussion episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Check out Medscape.com or the Medscape app for show notes, links, and more information on psoriasis.